Skull, everybody. This is Alexander Ludwig, and you are listening to The Wild Hunt.
Welcome back to The Wild Hunt, the No Ship Network podcast on the History Channel series Vikings. I am your host, Steve.
And I am your host, Em.
All right. How you guys doing? We're doing back-to-back podcasts tonight. We just finished with season 5, episode 1. Now we're doing season 5, episode 2. This one is entitled...
The Departed.
The Departed. It is written by Michael Hurst and directed by David Wellington. So just like last episode, we're doing it by character blocks. First up, I wanted to talk about Ivar and what happened to him.
Okay.
So when we first, the first time we see him, we actually see Fitzurk and Uba coming up to talk to him, and they're thwarted by some bodyguards who just don't want to let him through.
Right.
And the guy who is listed as White Hair, this guy's like huge. He's just towering over Uba, and he's like, hey, you're going to let me through, or I'm going to nail you to that fucking post over there.
That is his most prominent feature.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, I guess if you had to give him a nickname, that works. So the bodyguards stand down because they're intimidated by these two, maybe not necessarily because of their physicality, but because of their known prowess in battle, perhaps, or the fact that they're Ragnar's sons. I don't know. But they didn't want to let him through, and they kind of stood their ground, and then they got through.
Yeah, but the fact that they didn't want to let them through, and especially Whitehair pushing that issue further than you would have guessed he would have once they said, hey, don't you know who we are? I think Ivar actually gave orders to
keep them out.
To keep them out, or at least give them a hard time, especially Uba.
So he's just messing with their heads then.
That's what I think happened.
So everybody else is making battle preparations. Then this guy, you know, I praised him so much for his tactical decision-making skills in the first episode of this season, even though he is a little bit immature, but then his immaturity really wins out in this scene because you've got the army coming up to York from the south, it looks like. And what do you have? What's he doing? He's getting a back piece done while his bodyguards harass his co-leaders and his brothers.
Isn't this the conversation where he says that I'm a cripple, or is that later?
Right, no, this is the conversation. So they get through the guards and they start to talk to him, and he's getting a back tattoo done.
Uh-huh.
And they kind of, the three brothers hash out their leadership schematic between them. And Ivar brings up that he says, look, I want to be seen as an equal to you guys, but for me to be seen as an equal, I have to be better than you because of my condition. And, you know, there's a very different reception to that statement between the brothers because
yes.
Uba's like, I accept you for who you are. You don't have anything to prove to me. You just need to be making good decisions is what's left unsaid. Whereas you hear Fitzurk off screen, he's like, don't try to get us to feel sorry for you. You know what I mean? That's not going to work. Don't bring up the cripple thing.
Well, I think that Ivar favored Fitzurk's reaction over Uba's because Uba is almost saying, I accept that you're a cripple. Basically still going, I know that's what you are, and I'm going to accept it, and you're going to remain that in a way. Where Fitzurk says, don't make us feel sorry for you, which I think is what Ivar wants. He wants somebody to...
challenge him or push him?
Doesn't want to be pitied because I think he feels like he's had too much of that, especially from Auslaug.
Okay, so this is what's spurring him on, obviously, to... Because, you know, you have the... since we're staying with characters, it's going to go right into... This is one of the... this is only the fourth scene in the episode, but the next scene that still has all these characters is actually the one of the very last scene. But...
And I think this is why Ivar and Fitzurk get along better is because of this sort of understanding that has developed between them where it's lacking between Uba and Ivar.
So do you think that Ivar might perceive it to be some sort of weakness on Uba's part that he is accepting of him even though he's crippled? Like he's not forcing him to go, hey, don't lay this cripple bullshit on us. You know, either get better or don't, you know, get to the level we need you to be or don't expect the respect that you want.
I don't think he places value on what Uba wants from him. Like, I think the idea of being a man and what he thinks he needs to do to prove himself as a man is a lot different than what Uba thinks is manlike.
Yeah. So they're just not connecting is what it's all about.
Or he could just be crazy. Which is probably more likely, and we're discussing this to death.
He's psychotic is what it boils down to. Okay. All right. So the next scene that has all of these characters and Ivar in it is Ivar gets himself some leg braces. And for the first time, we see him stand up on his own and he is able to look his brothers in the eyes. You know, and it's funny that Floki had said in the last episode, he's like, why don't you stand up and say that to my face? Now he's able to stand up and say that stuff to people's face.
We've actually seen him attempt to do that because he had leg braces made before in Kattegat that didn't work out so well. And he, there were snickers that...
Yeah, they were laughing at him.
Yeah. So it actually kind of puts like another emphasis on Floki saying that, which I believe he has said that to him before, at least once before, and probably a lot more that we haven't seen depicted on, in the show, where it's kind of like been a something that was used to goad him to actually get him to actually achieve that.
Right. Like, so he wasn't just being a dick. He's trying to get him to rise up to his full potential, like any leader or mentor should do for people.
Stand on your own two feet.
Literally and figuratively.
Yeah.
So he's pretty intimidating, though, when he, you know, he's standing up all the way. It's like you're just not used to seeing that guy like that, obviously.
And that's how this episode ended, right?
Right. And that's how the episode ended. And that concludes our coverage of this episode. So the next up would be Aethelwulf, Judith, and Alfred. So you've got Judith and Aethelwulf are discussing Alfred's poor health, and it seems like this is kind of a conversation that takes place a little bit too much for Aethelwulf's taste. He's just kind of like, yeah, do we really have to talk about him again? You know, I'm not even his real father. I've taken care of him enough. Now he's becoming a man, and now he's just too sickly to even survive.
That's not how I took it. Actually, I think he loves Alfred as he would his own son. Mm-hmm. I think he's actually trying to connect with Judith, and he wants that connection, but he doesn't want the conversation to always be about Alfred. He wants to connect on other things because they're finally like have a clean start here where they could actually have a husband and wife relationship.
Mm. While they're all dirty and muddy. I'm not sure what's wrong with Alfred, what he's suffering from specifically. It's not made clear to us. And he actually comes out of it in this episode. He becomes more healthy after he sees what he says is his father.
Bog sickness or something.
Bog sickness, yeah. It looks like he just needs some vitamin D and some sun to synthesize it. You know, it's that's about it. You know,
yeah. Whatever Judith was cutting into was like some weird moldy bread or some extremely waterlogged gross cheese.
Either one is just is disgusting, and it's not a diet that you want to have. You know, where's the vegetables? Where's the vitamins? So, they go and look out for Alfred, and Alfred is in the water, kind of striking a Jesus Christ kind of figure and walking through the water with his white robe and his long hair and so on and so forth. And he has a vision of a black robed figure that's a little bit further than him in the water. And he reaches out, and there's no sound that lets you know that there's any kind of – there's sound to the scene, but there's no voices. There's no dialogue that's going on between the two. So you're not really sure what's being said until he falls into the water. And then Judith starts screaming, like, save him, like any mother would. Mm-hmm. And so Aethelwulf does the good thing, and he saves the kid, gets him up out of the water, and they think he's dead, and he starts spitting out the nasty brown bog water, which just looked absolutely filled with peat or whatever that stuff
tannic
is.
Tannic acid.
That's right. Tannic acid, yeah. Mm-hmm. And tannic acid looks gross in water. That's all I'm saying. So he says that he says he had a vision from – or no, he – well, first he says that they need to go to York because that's where the Northmen are, and that your people need you, speaking to Aethelwulf, because he's their king and he's going to be able to rally them around. And when they ask him, like, who told you this? Judith asks him that. He says, my father. So I guess that was who was in the robe, was Athelstan.
Yeah, even though you couldn't see inside the cowl, it was just like there was no face. It was like a ghostly apparition making that humanoid form under that robe.
So what's, just as an aside, what's your specific opinion on that? Do you think that they should have brought George back and just had him do Athelstan as a Obi-Wan type ghost?
They maybe had hoped to. Maybe there was a conflict with his schedule and they couldn't. So this is what they did.
Yeah, because he's moved on to other projects. That's true. Yeah. Yeah. And, yeah. I think at a certain point, though, you have to leave that behind anyway. So I'm glad that they didn't.
Yeah.
You know, because if you can't break away, get that clean break and move into the appreciation and involvedness with the other characters if you just keep bringing back the old characters that everybody loves as apparitions every third episode. So that's good.
Yeah, because then we'll never let go.
Yeah, exactly.
And we need to let go so we can move forward.
It's for us.
Yes.
So King Aethelwulf takes that to heart. And so he leads the troops, which I thought this was a weird scene transition because everybody looks like they're living in their bathrobes and rooting around in this muddy water. And then all of a sudden they're on the move as a army that has all of their gear on.
Regalia.
Yeah. So it's like, okay, I guess they had that in a storage hut somewhere, or they had all the, you know, the army was camped out somewhere else. I understand that they're in hiding because they're kind of like royalty in exile.
Well, even Judith's posture had an assuredness to it.
It is really all about your attitude, isn't it? You know, just put on some good clothes, get cleaned up, sit upright, have good posture, and you've got half of the job done right there. So as they make their way towards York, Lord Denewolf, who is attached, obviously, to Bishop Haman, he meets one of Aethelwulf's scouts, and they're like, oh, okay, good. We just met, the good guys. They both recognize each other as good guys, which is kind of a good scene because you have far too many of those scenes where it's like, who are you? And then somebody gets an arrow or axes start flying or something like
that. Well, yeah. And I think we've actually, it was in an identical space or it's the exact same space they've used for this scene where we've actually had conflict in an area like that.
Like they used that same exact spot outside.
It was very familiar looking.
I don't see why they wouldn't really, because if you noticed, but how many people might really notice that if it is the same spot, because you just put different people in a different timeline in different uniforms, and it's like, it's all new again. So now we have we get the meeting between Bishop Haman and King Aethelwulf. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the bishop does the thing. He goes down on one knee and he's like, my lord king. But Aethelwulf here is kind of like, oh, no, get up. You know, I've heard a lot about you. You're a great guy. We could all, you know, be better people if we lived by your example. Mm-hmm. And you're so pious and this and that. So you get these guys meeting finally for the first time, and it reminded me of something that you had talked about during the previous podcast about how Bishop Haman had the wrong idea about Ecgberht. And now
he doesn't know him like we do anymore.
Right. Yeah, he doesn't, because he's got a you know, this vision of him that's kind of on a pedestal. And then now you've got Aethelwulf doing the same thing to him. You know, like, oh, yeah, you're so pious and so this and, mm-hmm. and devout and whatever. And it's like, yeah, and he's pretty much banging every woman that, you know.
Yeah, he's going to be disillusioned, and that'll be interesting. And it seems like they're trying to set up that, like, Judith might be that thing.
That's what I was going to mention next.
I'm hoping Judith doesn't.
I'm hoping not either. She seems like she would be above that, even with all of the muck and mire that she's put herself into with her association with Ecgberht mm-hmm. over the years and the things that she's done. I would still hope that this would be beneath her, because it would just be too obvious. It mm-hmm. would be like, oh, okay, yeah. Here we go.
And also prior to Aethelwulf and Haman meeting, we actually heard a comment from Haman where he was talking about Aethelwulf he's credited as a warrior. So he's already got a high appraisal of Aethelwulf himself.
Yeah, there was a bromance like prepackaged here for these two guys. You know, they're just like, they're complimentary of each other's ideas for the most part. You know, I think there was some stuff that you could read on Aethelwulf's face towards the end of their conversation that was like, I don't know what to make of it, but it didn't look like pure joy or anything mm-hmm. like that. But I think they have enough respect for what the other one is trying to do and who they are and what could get done. And they need each other. They need each other's armies. They need each other's support. And it's kind of a hand in glove type thing. So Judith lets Haman know that she's not just going to be some sort of shrinking violet who stays at the castle while her boy and her husband are out there insisting on being in battle and stuff like that. And she has a stake in this as well. She wants to see the pagans brought to justice or put to death or both because of what they did to her father, who is King Aela.
Which is all fine and good. But I feel like they want to explain to us why she's there in battle, because I'm not sure if realistically that she would have been there. You know, historically speaking, if Aethelwulf,
it's a good point,
would have allowed her. So I think if they're going to create like a tension between Judith, Hammond, and Aethelwulf because of Hammond's weakness towards women, they have to have an explanation as to why Judith is there in the first place.
It still fits though, because if they had been in Wessex and this was going on and they had to fight the Norsemen on another front, it would make a lot more sense for Judith to stay at the castle.
Yeah.
But there's no castle for them now. They were just living in a fishing hut off of, you know, some swamp somewhere. So because they're kind of like in exile, you know, because the Northmen kicked them out of where they had to run. So they don't have a safe place for her to go. She could stay at that camp while they went out. So hopefully we're not going to see her on the battlefield, because that might stretch the credulity a little bit too much. But we'll see. So they make their battle plans, and Bishop Haman is very, he's aggressive in the way that he just kind of takes control of the situation, but he's also seeming to be a little bit cautious about this. So I'm not really sure how to read him, because he's saying, let's wait, let's send our scouts out to make sure that these Roman walls that we've heard about are not going to crumble down when we try to use them, because they're outside of the city and they're unmanned and they could use that to their advantage, tactically speaking. So this kind of, I don't know if this fits as well with the guy who was in episode one of this season, who, when I think it was Denewolf had come up to him and said, listen, these Vikings have taken over the city. They're industrious. You know, you have to be careful of them. And he's like, no, they're not. They're pagans and they're, you know, devil worshipers or whatever. And don't worry about it. We'll just go in there and kill them. And it's like, you know, nobody has ever come out on the good side of underestimating the Vikings.
Maybe so. That was more of like just fighting the mythology that's starting to build about the Vikings. And because that's like, it's like kind of like a propaganda thing where fear is being instilled in the people. So if you can kind of try to dismantle that a little bit, you know, and then you can gird up your men to be better fighters because they don't have that fear.
Okay, I can see
debilitating
that.
Them. Well, I mean, fear is obviously a huge part of battle. That's why warriors dress as they do, to make themselves look larger, spikier, and, you know, more like that just brushing up against them would cut you. Stuff like that. So it's that intimidation factor is probably a large percentage of success.
So it's a great, you know, at first I looked at it as, I'm kind of changing my opinion on it now, because first I looked at it as a dismissal and an underestimation.
It could be that too.
Of the Vikings, which I think is always a mistake when you underestimate the Vikings. But you're absolutely right. There's no reason to give your troops a solid but undue reason to fear their enemy before they even get on the battleground. You know, they're men. They can be cut and bleed and die just like any other person. So,
he's definitely not a brash guy. And I think, you know, there's been a couple of things in this episode that is supposed to be building him up as a formidable warrior, because you have the first scene with him, I believe, is when he's cathartically cutting open that carcass, that deer carcass.
Because he's got the carcass like strung up, and he's just, like you said, it almost seems like it's his morning ritual of like, it's kind of quasi prayer
and release and
a little bit of like also training.
Yeah.
To, you know, for the battlefield and stuff like that. And he cuts that thing up. And this is actually the scene where it precedes the one that we were already covering. But this is the one where they learn about York being taken and how what had happened to poor Bishop Kennenbert, you know, who got the gold down the throat and everything. So
I think, you know, you were talking about his strategy as far as like prepping to retake York and how they're going to, you know, have this steady data collecting about the wall and whatever. But, you know, also seeing him cut into that deer, and with that being a release, the fact that it's a release, he's got bloodlust, don't you think? I mean, so that makes him dangerous in that way.
Yeah, I would agree, because if he needs to do that, if he has to the point where, I mean, most people would just find a sparring partner, you know, or, you know, practice their moves against a tree, because it's going to be just as effective, really. This guy has to have the actual feeling of the flesh being torn asunder and seeing the blood and hearing the, you know, the smells, the sights, the sounds, everything.
Maybe it's a replacement for sex, too.
Well, he's trying to sublimate, if that's the case, you know, and he's trying to take that sexual urge, repress it, and then move it into another area of his life to kind of harness the power of it and make him more effective in something else. That's what you do when you do that. But so if it is linked to sexuality, hopefully it's just linked to it in the sense that it makes him a better warrior if he is not giving into his sexual urges, holds those in.
So he won't be weak in the knees for battle.
And he won't be weak in the knees. As Mickey used to say, women weaken legs, right?
Right.
So we're saving Floki for last, because just it feels good to end the episode that way with everything that happens in Floki's story. And the cinematography on that is just so great. But anyway, we're going to get – this is a very Lagertha – I don't know how to say this word – Lagertha-centric episode. So this is where the real meat of this episode is, and most of the stuff that we're going to talk about. So we start her part of this episode with her visiting Harold, where she has him chained up. and all he has on is, it looks like a pair of gym shorts or something like that. So I'm supposing this is part of his underdress. And Harold explains, as best he can, that why he perpetuated this treachery. And it all boils down to the fact that he loved the woman, and she had told him that, yes, I'll be your wife if you can become king of all Norway. And it's kind of like saying, you know, to somebody, yeah, I'll marry you if you can bring me back $100 billion. You know, they're probably not going to do it. So you just go on about your life and blah, blah, blah. So he figured out, and we saw all this last season unfold and we got his story. He figured out that she had married somebody else anyway, and that she was lying to him. And when she says, so what did you do? He says, oh, I killed her. Like, you know, like it was just, well, I washed the dishes at the end of the night or took out the trash or whatever. No big deal. Just killed her.
Yeah. And I think she didn't like that.
No, I would guess that she wouldn't. No, even though you could almost look at it the other way, I agree with that. Let me just say that she didn't like that. Mm-hmm. But one could be forgiven for looking at it the other way and looking at the way that she killed Kalf, you know, and that was a different thing. It had to do with untruth, and it had to do with something that she said she was going to do at some point. So there's a lot of differences there, but still they could find a common ground there, but I don't think she's having that. So Harold, he's got nothing to lose at this point. He's already chained up. So he says, look, you need me. You know, you can't trust the Ragnarssons as far as you can throw them. You know, they're still loyal to Aslaug. You killed her. So there's going to be a reckoning for that at some point, because Ivar hasn't forgiven Lagertha. He's just interested in doing other stuff right now. So that's going to come around. There's going to be other people that are going to contest your claim to this throne. So why don't we form an alliance? I can offer you protection, friendship, and you're single, I'm single, so, you know,
yeah,
we could hook up and be married. Mm-hmm. Why not? And she's not having that. I mean, she pulls that knife out of the leg holster, yep, and she's just like, okay, so what, I think I have the exact quote here where she said, she's upset at the presumption that she would prostrate herself at his feet and just be so happy to be his wife and bask in the glory that is King Harold and stuff like that. So she brings the knife over and she brings it down and she cuts the pants off. And then I didn't realize what was happening at first when I was first watching this. I'm like, what? Wait a minute. And then she rapes this guy. Mm-hmm. So let's discuss.
Well, once he does this marriage proposal, I think this is when she snapped. That's at the moment she angrily hikes up her dress and she pulls that knife out. And it just, on my second rewatch, I was thinking about it because I was thinking of her first marriage, her second marriage, the following marriage proposals, and the engagement to Kalf. Or with her past experiences with marriage or marriage proposals being mostly terrible, a marriage proposal currently signifies a threat. So her hackles get raised. It's go time. And I think she does this to show the power pendulum has shifted into her sphere. She needs to assert to him, at least, that no, I'm in the power position here. That no, I'm not going to be the wife prostrate before you, gazing up at you. That I am going to be in the power position. I'm in charge. I decide what's what. And here's proof, because I'm raping you.
Yeah, there's no doubt about that, that she is in the power position.
He escapes really easily, which pisses me off.
That felt more like for the story than anything else, because I feel like it hasn't I can't recall off the top of my head, but has it been really easy for anybody to escape from Kattegat, you know, when they were in chains?
When she took power, they were invaded pretty easily.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And sometimes she just looks weaker than she needs to be for the story to go forward. I think it does a disservice sometimes for the strength of Lagertha that we're supposed to believe in, that I believe is actually there. But, you know, sometimes the story doesn't really line up with that. It's like, it's ridiculous that he was able to escape that easily.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree, because it wasn't very long after that at all that the kidnapping of Astrid took place.
Like, Ragnar had no problem keeping Jarl Borg in prison.
Yeah. So what, did he just have better guards?
What's the difference?
What is the difference? Now, I did notice that after she has her way with him and she leaves, you have a close-up of his face, but the door does not get, it gets kind of, she kind of pushes it and it doesn't shut back into place. It slams shut and then pops open again.
So it almost makes it worse. It's like she personally is responsible.
If that's the case, yes. If that's the case.
See, maybe that's supposed to be a commentary how anger can impair judgment.
Yeah.
And you do rash things.
Yeah, that's, yeah, it's a good...
Like leaving doors ajar.
Yes.
When you have a prisoner inside.
Okay, so how do you feel about Lagertha after this scene? Has your opinion changed of her in any way, shape, or form, knowing that she was... Rape is about power.
Yes.
And she wielded her power over this person. And notwithstanding what, you know, we think that he, what ill treatment he deserves for all of the dastardly stuff that he's done in his lifetime, how does it make you feel about her, you know, as a character? Because I know I always had problems. Like, as much as I wanted to like Rollo at certain times, I always remembered the times that he was a bastard. And it just, so now we've got one of those, you know, a notch in that column for one of our favorite characters ever.
I wish she had done something different. I feel like she stooped doing that. I can't advise her in any way. It's like, how do you let him know that you're in power? What other way?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah.
Other than just keeping him in prison, and maybe you just need to keep him in prison longer and dehydrate him and not feed him, and
right,
and maybe take your men into some of his, you know, territory and start just taking over his land. I don't know why that's not an option.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm just curious. I don't want.
I don't like that she did that. As far as Catherine Winnick's acting, I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah. Yeah. And I just want it to be known. I'm not trying to make this a double standard thing. Like, all of the Viking men can do whatever they want to, and we still root for them at the end of the day. I'm still rooting for Lagertha. I'm just like, whoa, I did not expect that to happen. Yeah. So.
And, you know, and this might be illustrating something that Margrethe is seeing about Lagertha, because she's arguing that, you know, she's seeming weak, and weak people have to assert their power in terrible ways. Mm-hmm. And rape would be one of those things. Yeah. So is she correct?
I don't know. I mean, we're gonna discuss that when we get to that part when she's talking about it and delve into it.
Okay.
Because I think there's definitely some stuff to be talked about there, because I, as much as I've liked Lagertha as a character, there's some truth to the criticisms that people are throwing at her. But anyway, we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. So now we get to the dinner scene where they're sitting down in the hall and she's eating with Astrid, Torvi, Margrethe, and you know, she talks about what her meeting was about with Harald, saying how he wanted an alliance, and he was offering an alliance and protection in return for marriage. And Astrid is getting pretty indignant about this. She's like, yeah. I would never stoop so low as to be, I think her exact quote was, I would never let a man like that get near me, which is kind of funny, because when you see what happens later on in the episode with her on the boat, the wheels are really turning in her head. So, but anyway, she says that now, and she's really at loggerheads with Lagertha on this, because she thinks it should be a non-issue from my point of view. That's how she's approaching it. But Lagertha is like, well, look, you know, I'm the leader here. I'm in this position. I have to consider certain things. And Torvi brings up a really good point when she says, sometimes women have to do what women have to do to keep a bit of power. And Astrid is very upset that those words were spoken. She was like, says you, kind of thing. But Lagertha is like, actually, she's right. And it's an unfortunate truth. And unfortunately, it still feels like, to some certain extent, it's almost still true now.
Yeah, I just, I'm more aligned with Astrid on this subject, because I always favor characters who are more rigid in their moral values, but I do question her morals because she was sleeping with Bjorn. But anyway, but maybe that's more of something else that, you know, doesn't really apply. But anyway, because I feel like you're selling yourself short, or you're taking the legs out from under your main goal when you not meet certain moral standards. And I think there's more value in maybe not gaining as much ground as you would without taking some shortcuts. It just might take longer to get there, but eventually you will, and you'll do it in style and class. And
so you're saying take the slow, steady road and arrive with your integrity intact.
Yeah, I guess I just need to communicate better. But yes,
okay,
that is, well, what I'm saying.
It strikes me that there's a little bit of commentary on the way that actual politics works here. Because what Lagertha is saying is like, yes, this person's despicable. They tried to have a spy come in with his troops and try to kill us. He expected that person to be on the throne when we got here, when he got back. And that plan didn't work. So now he's trying a different tact, but he still has some use and value to us, even though he really doesn't, because you would have to take him at his word. And I think if she had said, well, okay, I'll back up. Maybe if she had said, yes, I will marry you, then things would have been different. And he would have been like, well, I don't have to conquer Kattegat. I have it in my pocket now, and I can go forward and be the king of the rest of it and have that as an asset that I don't have to come back and steamroll over at some point. So he would have taken that. But having her not be down for that, she's trying to find the right way that she can compromise. You know, so Astrid is the voter who wants the politician to be completely ideologically pure at all times.
She wants Bernie.
She wants Bernie. And then you've got Torvi, who is going, well, look, compromise isn't always pretty to watch, but you have to do it to get things done sometimes. Mm-hmm. And so there's like, and then Lagertha as the leader is stuck in the middle between these two points of view where she's going, yeah, I kind of see both of you and I value both of your opinions and I love both of you, but I have to do what I have to do, so get off my freaking case, you know, so.
Yeah, I don't know, you know, what my final judgment is on it. I know in the perfect world that I want to live in is that all leaders lead by example, and there's no bullshit going on behind the scenes. But I also realize the world I do live in, and people don't really respect the people who do lead by example very much.
We're brought up to respect and revere, at least ostensibly, doing things by the book, doing things honestly, transparency. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
People who like I pride myself on being somebody who can be depended on. If I tell you I'm going to be somewhere to do something, whether it's a job or to help somebody move or whatever, I'm going to be there. You know what I mean? It's just how I am. And you know, it's a level of personal integrity that you want to achieve. And I know that's such a small thing in the big scheme of things. You know what I mean? Big deal. Steve showed up to help somebody move, or he clocked in for work. Great. You know, pat yourself on the back. But when we move further and further and further away from that, it's easy to become cynical with stuff. So I think there's a little bit of commentary going on here in this scene at the dinner table that relates to what's going on now. So Hurst has found a way to not date the show, but to still have it be a little bit of commentary on what's going on now. So I think it was genius.
Yeah, and especially having Lagertha in this light, you know, we've always really had a lot of high appraisal for Lagertha.
Yeah.
Most of the time. I did question her shooting Auslaug in the back, though. I know not everybody was on board with thinking that was lame, but I did. That's part of the dirtiness that Astrid wants to avoid, and that Torvi saying that sometimes you need to do.
Agreed. Yeah. And Astrid is not having it. She gets into the argument. She gets down to the nitty gritty with it. And she's just like, okay, well, you know, you're going to be a bitch about this. I'm going to go eat somewhere else. You know, I'm taking off for a while. And she leaves. And this is where she gets kidnapped by Harald's men.
Okay. And one more thing before we go into this, because there's going to be consequences for this rape. We talked about it on last episode about Halfdan having Harald's back, no matter how far away he is from him. I'm worried that this rape is going to be what is the impetus behind Lagertha's death, and it's going to be at Halfdan's hands when she's somewhere where there's marble walls or whatever the seer had said, doing it for his brother at his brother's behest.
God, I hope you're wrong, but it just sounds like it's so right. It sounds like it would really actually happen.
And it's almost like Auslaug saw that, because when she was shot in the back, she smiled as she fell to her death. And it's like she knew that behavior of Lagertha was the beginning of her end, that darkness that Lagertha started to embrace within her rule.
And see, this is the genius of Hurst's writing to me, because he can take characters and make them entirely human. And when you have a human character, no matter how much good they do, there's going to be a certain amount of bad in them, mm-hmm. because there's a certain amount of bad in all of us.
Well, there's desperation too, you know, and I think Lagertha feels like she's suffered so much and she's fought so hard. Maybe she's grasping at straws here now. I think, you know, whether she's really weak or not, it could be more just something that exists in her mind and might not actually be reality, but because it exists in her mind, it becomes reality.
Yeah, she doesn't know what to do. You know, she's having a crisis of, I mean, the points that he brought up about her needing some sort of protection, at least from Ragnar's sons, if not from other invading armies, is completely valid. But she does not want to go the route of marrying this guy and basically then ceding a certain amount, if not all, of her power to him and then just being a figurehead. Oh, I'm queen of Kattegat, so you get to just sit around and drink all day like Auslaug did? Or do you still want to be that person of agency who tries to expand your own kingdom that you you created. Mm-hmm. So that's a conundrum. What do you do? And I think you're right. I think she is a little bit desperate and she's in kind of like a crisis mode and she doesn't know which way to go and she made a mistake. So Astrid is kidnapped by Harold's men, and on the boat, Harold makes the same pitch, a little bit different, but basically the same pitch that he made to Lagertha to Astrid. He says, "Why don't you marry me and give me a bunch of sons and we can all live happily ever after?" And she's like, "Yeah, right. Get the fuck out of here. You know, that's never going to fly," which you would expect her to say. And she says, "Lagertha has given me everything. I'm not going to betray her." And then he kind of puts it a different way. And he says, "Listen to what I'm telling you, basically. You would be the most powerful woman in the whole country, the Queen of Norway, for nothing more than marrying me and having some of my kids." And he's like, "Look, I know that I'm not easy on the eyes and I haven't been lucky with women and all of this other stuff, but, you know, this could work." So she puts up a certain amount of resistance, but then she kind of stops talking. And you see the wheels slowly start turning in her head. Like, I don't think she got sold onto his idea right away, but I think she's like going, okay.
Not then.
You think that happened at that?
Because I think he gave her like whatever he was eating after that. And she's just like, ugh, still. Mm-hmm. I think if there was any wheels turning in her head, it didn't happen until he said, "What if you were always meant to be here? What if there was no place for you to be?" Because it made me think more about why we were shown Harold giving Bjorn's regards to Lagertha and Torvi, with Astrid being excluded from his regard. I knew there had to be a point to that. And I didn't really realize until I'd watched this second episode a second time. And I think that moment, coupled with Lagertha's preference towards Torvi at dinner, gives us an idea about how Astrid may be feeling about her value within Lagertha's world, and also just how she feels emotionally. It's also great thematically too, because I think a lot of people are trying to find that for themselves, a lot of these characters within this story. But I think that does go, okay, is she going to take what he's saying seriously because of how she is emotionally, because he's, you know, hitting the right notes right at that point? I want to believe no. I think, you know, if anybody's primed for that, it's Margrethe. But I don't know if she has any sort of royalty because she was a slave. So I doubt she could be that person. So then I'm like, oh, crap. What if it's Torvi? Because you do see Torvi really start to think after Margrethe is placing her arguments about Lagertha before her, because Torvi would be another.
And, you know, that's a really good point to bring up, because Torvi in episode one was talking with Guthrum after they did their battle. And he says, you know, "Well, my father's a great warrior." And they were talking about his father, and she said, "Your father was a great warrior." And he goes, "Well, he still is. He's alive," thinking about Bjorn. She's like, "No, your real father, mm-hmm. Jarl Borg. So, you know, that's who, you know, was his father." So, you know what I mean? So she was like, she was telling him to be proud of his lineage. You know what I mean? She was telling him to basically, not don't forget that you come from this person. That, so she's come to terms with that stuff.
Yeah. And I also think it was maybe meant to remind us who Guthrum is.
Yeah, that's true too. It might've been just a little bit of exposition to kind of give, because there's, it kind of gets convoluted, especially when you age advanced characters.
Yeah.
You have to go, now who is this again? Because, you know, there's some people who are fanatics of shows and they watch the season and they watch each episode three or four times while it's out. Then they buy the Blu-ray of the season, you know, as it comes out, and they watch that a bunch of times, and they're just, and then there's other people who are just
casual.
They're casual. So they come and they, you know, they watch it, and then, you know, they might forget a little thing or two. So it kind of serves a purpose. But back to what you were saying about, like Torvi and Margrethe, their conversation comes a little bit later, but there's a scene where Lagertha is talking to everybody who's still there, and she's saying, you know, and this kind of plays into what you were saying about Astrid being omitted from the salutations from Bjorn and stuff like that. So she's saying, "Listen, I don't understand why they took Astrid. She has a role to play in this, but I'm not sure what it is." So that kind of shows you how out of touch she's become with how everybody wants to be viewed by her. You see what I mean? So she doesn't even realize that there could be something that she doesn't even realize that there could be a crack in the cement that somebody could kind of get into with that. She's kind of oblivious to it because she's like, I don't know why they would pick her. Well, Harold picked her for a reason, and you already said what that reason was, because he knew that she would probably be the one most acceptable to those ideas if they were presented in the right way.
Yeah, I mean, if he's aware of he would have to have a lot of emotional intelligence to be able to, like, because he's the one delivering the news from Bjorn, and if he knows that she's primed for some sort of convincing in that way. But I don't know. I don't give him that much credit.
Okay, maybe not. We'll see. We'll see. I guess time will tell. But
that was like his third way of trying to ply her. He'd already tried, you know, two other ways, and now he's growing. Let's talk about your place in the world.
Well, Torvi says, you know, Astrid's not going to be part of anybody's plans. And then this is when Lagertha says the quote of the week for sure. She says, I'm old enough to know that you can never say for sure what someone else will do.
Mm-hmm.
So she's talking from experience with Ragnar, with her second husband, with Kalf, with everybody else. Yeah. Everybody else that she's come into contact with, even Ekbert and all these other people, it's just like, it doesn't make an excuse for ill behavior on her part necessarily, but she's jaded.
And her jadedness is what makes me think that Astrid will not. She's going to be the exception.
So you think that there's going to be somebody who has enough moral fiber to not take the...
Yeah, I'm hoping it's actually Astrid living by example will maybe set Lagertha straight.
Okay. All right. I would be down for that. I would love that, actually. Mm-hmm. I would love that, actually, because I don't share your attraction to characters that have a very, very rigid moral fiber. That's not necessarily a true statement. I don't like them as much as you do. You really go in for them. I like them sometimes because I feel like the rigidity can hold back progress that's a whole other conversation anyway.
I agree with that. And I don't know what it is, but I am like, you know, we've always debated Paula Mayo from the
Peter F. Hamilton books.
But I thought she was awesome.
And she's definitely that kind of character.
Yeah.
But so this statement to me, like I've already said, it's the quote of the week for sure. And it shows you everything that she's gone through. So now we've kind of talked about everything that's been said, even the second part of Harold's pitch to Astrid, you know, with the food and stuff like that. And, you know, it seemed to me like the wheels are turning, or I'll say this, Hurst wants you to think that the wheels are turning in her head. How about that? We'll just leave it at that. So the final scene that has to do with Lagertha and her characters is what you were talking about a little bit earlier. Margreth and Torvi discuss Lagertha's mistake, which Torvi's like, how is that actually a mistake? You know, she's like, well, she sacrificed Astrid's life for this and that and the other thing.
An exaggeration.
Yes, a big exaggeration. So, you know, Margreth is looking at this situation very much in her own way, and she has her own views on stuff. And, you know, it occurred to me that her affinity with Ragnar's sons, and those sons being of Oslaug, kind of puts her in the camp that might not be as forgiving of any missteps that Lagertha makes.
Except Ivar is the one that's the most vengeful, and she fears him the most. So it seems like, I mean, I think she hangs around with Lagertha because I think she sees that as her primary source of protection.
Yeah, that's true too. Yeah.
But I think she's become disillusioned. And even though, like, Lagertha told her it's none of your business, so she's still in some way treated, even though she's no longer a slave, but she's treated as less than. She's in somewhat a place of privilege because she's able to step back and observe. So she may be coming from a place of wisdom as a result here.
Yeah, because she's going to be able to have, at the very least, you could say she could have an unbiased opinion if she didn't, you know, if the way I was coloring her character is not necessarily true, which it probably isn't, then she was able to, like you said, view things from an unbiased position.
Exaggerating.
She is exaggerating. She's to just come out there and say it was a mistake on her part, on Lagertha's part, and she was right to call it that, but it's bold of her to kind of just be like, yeah, she's not confident anymore. She's lost power. She's weak. She's this, she's that. It's like there's signs of that stuff coming down the road, but she's not there yet, and there's still time to turn it around.
Oh, she's raping somebody? She's weak. She's right.
Okay, but as far as her, that's a personal character failing. I'm talking about as a leader.
Mm-hmm.
So I mean, maybe it can still apply.
It's a symptom of how she feels about her leadership. I mean, she just can't get very far without somebody constantly on her doorstep challenging her leadership. It just never goes away.
So it makes me wonder at the time how many, you know, how many, I don't know historically how many like queens there were, how many people there were in that position that were females, you know? So it makes you think that if you were constantly besieged on all fronts because you were seen as intrinsically weaker than men. Even if you were a shield maiden who could probably kick most of the men's ass that you know, you were still, you know, seen as the weaker sex, and therefore your possession of that title was a prize to be had by somebody else at some point. It was just a matter of time kind of thing. But they didn't feel that way necessarily about Ragnar. Okay, so that wraps it up for what was going on with Lagertha's camp, which was the real meat of the story, and there was a lot to talk about there. But so Floki, the Floki part of the story is what I'm going to end on because it ends on a much more positive note. And it's poetic and it's beautiful. And there's obviously not a lot of dialogue because the only thing that he says is out loud to the gods and things like that. So you when you first see him in this episode, the sea is becalmed and he's lost. He's gotten to the point where that goofiness, that silliness that's always been there kind of comes to the forefront, and he starts blowing into the sails. That doesn't work. So, okay, well, it is a rowboat too. So yeah, we'll just start rowing in whatever direction.
He hasn't completely given over to his fate or the gods. He's going to start trying to blow his own sails.
So he feels abandoned by the gods, appealing to Heimdall, the watchman, to let the other gods know that he always is observant and keeps them in his heart. And, you know, that is actually, it doesn't sound like desperation because coming from Floki, that's always true.
Yeah.
He's always been, to me, the Viking that we get to, the featured Viking that we get to see who is closest to
the
keeping
religion.
Yeah, their religion. So so he sets the raven free. He's dehydrated. He's out of food. He's at his wit's end, and he does an act of kindness to this bird. You know, he could have tried to cook and eat it, or if he had, I don't know if you want to set a fire on a boat, that probably doesn't sound like a good idea, or he could have drinking its blood and gotten some sort of hydration out of it, I would imagine. But, I don't know, maybe the salt content in there would kind of negate that. You might as well drink the seawater. Anyway, he does an act of kindness to the bird and sets it free. His ship is tossed around in a storm, and he sings. You know, what else? What is there left to do? He just sings. He passes out at some point and he wakes up in a strange land, which we can only assume to be Iceland, right?
Yes.
And he sees his raven has made it to this land as well. And he finds a little tiny patch of fresh water on a rock and tests it first, and he's slurping it up.
Yeah. So. I mean, dehydration will, you know, you will do desperate things like drink up dirty ass water. I watched this documentary, which is based on a book called Touching the Void. And I highly recommend people watch that because it's based on a true story. But, you know, it's amazing. It's interesting what your body will do when you're severely dehydrated. I was wondering if that lava would act like charcoal if it was actually super filtered because of all that lava rock.
That's a good question. I don't think the water was, I think that water would be safe to drink. At that point in time, nobody's been there before.
Yeah, but bacteria is really the problem.
I don't know. I just worry about like pollution more than, you know, man-made stuff once the Industrial Revolution came around or other people's shit.
Amoebas. Amoebas are the problem in water. Like the brain-eating thing that happens when you swim in stagnant hot water in the South, that's a brain-eating amoeba.
Is that why you always get mad at me when I do that?
Yes.
So he has a rough first night. He's cold. He's shivering. He has to take off his wet clothes and, you know, kind of get under the drier furs and set a fire and everything. And he just kind of shivers through it. And it's, I don't know if part of that's like he's getting a little bit of hypothermia or he's still dehydrated or what it is. But I mean, this is a Northman. I mean, he grew up in, you know, somewhere around Norway or Sweden. So he's used to the cold. Mm-hmm. So it's got to be pretty cold out there. And he starts exploring the next day.
Thankfully, he had that pelt
right
that he was able to wrap himself up. But, you know, once you get that warm, it's like the contrast. It's the best warmth. At least I hope that's what he was feeling.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. When you're super cold and you were wet, then you get dry and then you get warm.
Or when it's super cold out and you get in your car and you have to drive and you blast your heat in your car, it feels so good.
So maybe he stayed there for like a whole day and we just don't know it.
Yeah.
It's a couple days later or something. And he climbs up onto a pretty high ridge up there, and that's where you see the toy boat that you were talking about.
Yeah, behind him. His boat that looked like a toy.
And he sees a volcano. And so this has got to be something completely new to him. He's never been anywhere where he's seen a volcano before, I wouldn't imagine. Then he comes up pretty close to a waterfall. I think he starts hallucinating because he starts seeing the waterfall run backwards.
Well, let's see. He has fell at some point and his hand got bloody too.
Oh, okay. So he could be.
So I wonder if that made him question whether he was alive or dead at that point. Because he's like, oh, I must be alive. I'm bleeding. But then he sees the waterfall go backwards and then that apparition come through, the horned apparition, which you think is Loki.
Yeah, the way that Loki's always been portrayed in the comic books, it had that kind of like the two prongs coming out of the headgear. So that's what made me think it was Loki. Now he's convinced that he's in Asgard. So we'll see what happens from there. But here you have this character who has always been, you get the most out of him when he's interacting with the other characters on the show. And here he is doing a solo run. You know, this whole episode, he didn't interact with another living thing except for the crow, and that very briefly. So I don't know if he's going to run into a settlement here, or if he's going to try to build a bigger boat, sail back, and then bring people there, or how this is going to work. But this is actually what is going to happen with Bjorn in the Mediterranean with Bjorn and Halfdan, and what Floki is going through, to me, are the big interests for me this season. And then Lagertha's situation falls in behind that. And then last place is what's going on in England, I would say. All right. So that wraps up our coverage of season 5, episode 2, The Departed. And now we are going into feedback.
All right. We've got 3 pieces of feedback. And just so everybody knows that going forward from after this podcast, we're asking that you keep your feedback pretty short. Just have like Dolly, a general, when she would write in her feedback, she would do these bullet points. I feel like that's an ideal way of expressing yourself that we can do easily without having to edit you too much. Otherwise, we will have to edit you because our Vikings podcast tends to get a lot of feedback and we want to include everybody's feedback. So try not to have it so we're editing your points. We want to make sure you're getting across what you want to get across. But today we only have 3 pieces of feedback, so we're going to read everything. And up first, we have PB&J. Hi, PB&J. It's nice to hear from you. It's been a while.
What's up?
He says, hey, guys, it's been too long. TGI Vikings is finally back. It's funny how much you realize you miss something once you see it again. The sting of losing Ragnar is a fading memory. I'm beginning to think that's the reason for this long off season. We all needed time to mourn. Anyway, I guess this season is going to be full of all kinds of conflict. Ivar wasn't kidding when he declared war against the world. I'm not sure, but I think they're suggesting Bishop Hammond may be some sort of precursor to the Knights Templar. I wonder that too because of the sigil, the Red Cross sigil on his men's shields or flags. I can't remember which it was. I looked it up to see if it was exactly, but it's not exactly, but they're similar to the Knights Templar sigil. Anyway. PB&J says, maybe it was the million commercials they ran for Nightfall. I don't know. Anyway, I like the conflict of the two Holy Crusaders, Ivar versus Hammond. I think I'm going to call the bishop Holy Steamroller from now on. Seems Ivar will have to take out Ube at some point. When they were killing everyone in that church, Ube had his look on his face like, damn, son. I don't think he's down with Ivar's vision. Ube is the most like Ragnar, as he constantly reminds us. Floki's side adventure was interesting. His visit to Iceland and the way they filmed it reminded me of Valhalla Rising, that cool Mads Mikkelsen movie. Did you see that boat Floki made? Not only did he whip that thing out in record time, but he also had time to carve that super cool snake on the front of the boat. Pretty cool. Lastly, I hope they don't give Vikings the Chris Hardwick treatment with an after show because that pre-show thing was the suck. So happy to have Vikings and no shit back. TGI Vikings.
I'm not.
I didn't see the pre-show. So
I didn't see the pre-show either. And I could not imagine a Chris Hardwick after show doing. I don't know. Nothing against Chris Hardwick. I just I would not be interested in watching Chris Hardwick comment on Vikings. I'm just not really sure.
I don't think Vikings is his thing. It's not Doctor Who.
Exactly. It's like there's some things that I would listen to Chris Hardwick go on for 45 minutes because he's a really entertaining guy, actually. But Vikings just doesn't seem to fit the bill, so I don't know.
Yeah.
Did you see, did you see this?
Yeah. We watch Vikings through Amazon Prime, so we have to wait till pretty much the next day to be able to watch it. So we can't watch it as it comes out. So we don't get the pre-show or anything like that, unfortunately. Otherwise, I would watch it. Mm-hmm. So thank you, PB&J. It's nice to hear from you again.
Yeah, thanks.
Up next, we have Dunkin' Donuts. And she says, hey, guys, so glad to be back with you all. And I have so many thoughts. I don't know where to start and what to leave out. Let's start with the positives. There were some stunning moments in this episode that really left me breathless. And those were the Aethelwulf / Judith and Floki stories. That horrible swamp settlement that again made me question who are the real barbarians. Consider this my membership renewal in the Dream Wolf fan club because I thought Mo Dunford and Jenny Jax absolutely killed it with his little resentments of Alfred, but at the same time, still totally being that guy risking his life to save him. Judith freaking out that he was implying it was her fault again, but him finally being like, listen, we've all fucked up, kid. We're equal in that. I loved it. Then with Floki's little chuckling Ragnar / Odin Raven, his serpent boat, his plea to Heimdall, and the first view from the mountainside with the volcano pointing back to the ocean. Ugh, just so fucking gorgeous. His fatherly embrace of Ivar filled my cold black heart because otherwise, I don't really care for Ivar. The serpent boat caught my eye, not only for the obvious shout out to Ragnar, but because it's reminiscent of Jörmungandr, the Midgard serpent that starts Ragnarok. See, I didn't even think of that one. Yeah.
That's the world serpent, right?
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Floki's faith always interests me because he's not a conventional believer. His faves are the fringe guys like Heimdall, Angerboda, and Jörmungandr, and likewise, they seem to appreciate him. Hammond is okay, but right now he's just a lot. Downsides, yeah. I'm really tired of seeing Ivar's molars and his chariot. I get it. He's crazy. Now show me something else about him. But guess what? The brother they spent the most time with on screen is dead now. Why? I don't like this weirdness they're doing with Ube because his character needs to solidify. He's been on screen 2 seasons now. Never mind me too. Someone please just stab him. He must be talking about Fitzirk.
Oh, jeez.
Astrid, terrible. She still looks like she can't hold a sword. Æthelred, please give him a personality. Margrethe, hate her. What does she know about Lagertha, politics, or really anything? Can she not whine for 1 second? And Bjorn, when is he going to stop mugging like a monkey? I love Alex Ludwig, but for real, he hasn't had a personality in at least a season. Lastly, I really, really hated what the writers made Lagertha do with Harold. I see what they intended, but the reality is she raped him and still didn't outwit him. As Ragnar's equal, I wish they made her his true equal in wit and cunning. This was just a totally disappointing turn of events, and I wish these crusty old white dudes writing the show could see that what they've done to the heroine of the story for the sake of the gods. You can't promote her as a hero, but also have her do this. Stop it. No. Down. Sprays in face. bonus note, color of the episode was blue. Pop quiz, name all 3 women who wore it. Astrid, Judith, I'm going to say Torvi.
I think you're right about Astrid and Judith. I don't remember, because I thought Torvi was wearing some. Now, she might have been wearing blue at the table. Mm. I'm going to go with Guthrum as my answer.
Guthrum's a guy.
Sure.
So. Okay. Donut says, last thought. I was taken aback when Ivar stood up and was bigger than his brothers. Oop. All right, guys. Next week, I'll be more erudite, but I am throwing my kid's birthday party tomorrow, and I'm losing my mind right now. Skull! D Donuts, a.k.a. Dr. D's.
Thank you, Donuts.
Yes, thank you, Donuts. Go ahead.
Good. All right. I'll start with Alex Ludwig. Mugging like a monkey. He hasn't had a personality in at least a season. I agree with that. They are underusing his character. And I think it's done because they want us to. I think we're going to get a lot more of him in this season. So what I'm saying now might be negated by what comes forward in the further episodes. But I think that they're holding back a little bit on him because they don't want to take up all the air in the room when he's on the scene.
Yeah, because they're trying to let their other Ragnarsons.
Right.
But, ascend.
But, you know, we're two episodes in and we've gotten less than, you know, what merely minutes of screen time with him. Mm-hmm. So, you know, but we can't. I mean, there's more to come, and we can't really complain too much because last season, I mean, there was that whole thing where he killed the bear and yeah. stuff. So there was a lot of urine in there.
I really like, Donuts, how you honed in on the fact that Floki is not a conventional believer and that his faves are the fringe guys. I think that's super cool, and I never realized that, and that made me like Floki even more.
Yeah, he's not trying. You're absolutely right, and I didn't realize it either. He's not trying to appeal to Odin and Loki mm-hmm. and this god and that god. He's going with the... I mean, he's a believer. He knows the gods inside and out, so he's got his favorites. And so on to the elephant in the room with the rape scene. I think that Donuts sums it up pretty succinctly here when she says, "There was totally disappointing turn of events, and I wish these crusty old white dudes writing the show could see what they've done to the heroine of the story."
I agree that it is a disappointing turn. I don't like seeing her rape anybody. I mean, I would rather that she took the path that Astra would love for her to take. But I don't mind seeing Lagertha have issues with leadership. I think it's a very human thing.
I get what you're saying. I don't mind seeing her have issues with leadership, too. I mean, Donuts brings up that if she's supposed to be Ragnar's equal, let's see her be that cunning. Well,
yeah, I agree with that.
He was a special kind of cunning, though. That's why he was king, because he was so good at what he was doing. Not everybody, man or woman, can be expected to rise to that level. But I would rather, if she's going to, Lagertha is going to suffer from issues of leadership and bad leadership, I would rather have them be like what we talked about earlier, to where she tries her hardest to do the right thing, comes up against a wall, gets knocked down, fails, and has to get back up again and try mm-hmm. some more. I would rather see that than to see her stoop to what she did in this episode.
I don't know what the story's what's going to happen with the story going forward, so it's really hard to actually have thoughts on this, but it seems to me, as far as they're really wanting to look at choices regarding leadership with Lagertha.
Okay, well, let's do this then. We've already said a ton of stuff on it, so let's just kind of put that aside and then revisit this whole idea mm-hmm. of what got done to Lagertha's character for the expediency of the story at the end of the season okay. and see if we still feel that way. Yeah. Because, I mean, we've still got however many episodes left to go. So, I mean, we can gauge – I mean, we can – probably guess what's going to happen to a certain extent a lot easier than we could say with Twin Peaks. But, you know, there's mm-hmm. still a lot of questions out there. So we'll come back to it again and have a follow-up discussion at the end of the season and see like, okay, well, did our fears get borne out, or were they just kind of like, nah, shouldn't have worried about it.
Thank you, Donuts.
Thank you.
Our final piece of feedback comes from Undefeated Sam.
All right, Sam says, "Oh, it feels so good to have this show and the podcast back. So much has happened, so much change, and original crew are no more. As I watch the homie Floki leave after a sick-ass burn on Ivar, I know I have to adjust to a new crew. I'm still warming up to the Sons of Ragnar. At times, Ivar is like Chucky, gleefully evil, and it's his Charles Lee Ray-ness that makes me eager to see what else he'll do this season, as well as Uba and Vitserk. I expect great and unfortunate things from Bjorn too, but I'm most curious about seeing where this season takes Lagertha. After her mistake of not killing Harald, I'm wondering if my queen is slipping. I hope not. Not many shows have a woman this kick-ass. This was a great way to enter the new season and set up things to come. I hope our veterans find what they seek, and I hope the newbies can carry us forward. I can't wait to see what happens next."
Cool. So you agree then with Marguerite, Sam, that Lagertha's making mistakes. And I do agree. Like, I think she should have killed him.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He manipulated her into believing that she needed his help. He is correct. He used a little bit of truth, but he used a little bit of exaggeration at the same time. So,
well, she didn't kill him then because she already had it in her head that she needed him for some reason. I mean, is she fearing reprisal from somebody?
No, I don't think so. I'm not sure. But you're right, though. Not too many shows have a woman this kick-ass. So going, you know, kind of going back to what Donut's letter was saying, yet let's, you know, you don't want to pin it all on one character in one show and say you got to carry it. But, you know, I guess that's the way things end up sometimes. So hopefully things turn around. But we've got a lot of season left. So
yeah,
we'll see.
Just getting started. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, everybody.
Yeah, thanks for writing in.
I guess we haven't really talked about our schedule. I mean, we did mention it on the intro of last. So again, we're having to record Friday night. And so that means that our podcasts are not going to be released until mid-morning Saturdays. I'm going to get up early and just start editing right away. So there's going to be, you know, maybe like a 12-hour difference of release time. So before I, you know, worked half days at work and then I would come home and we would record and then I would edit that night. You guys will have it just a little bit later, but not too much later.
It'll still be Saturday.
So.
All right. So that concludes everything. Thank you for writing in and thanks for hanging out with us and listening to our coverage on a couple of great, great Vikings episodes that kind of put everybody's fears to rest. We will be back same time next week. This has been a No Ship Network podcast. I'm your host, Steve.
And I'm your host, Em.
Good night.